every culture has its iconic partnerships, the ones that stand out and somehow speak for their generation or for something that will outlast their brief moment in time. Ren and Stimpy, Calvin and Hobbes, Ernie and Bert. I'm sure you've got any number of them in your mind. You might even be in one of these enduring partnerships, the kind others look to for inspiration. But who stops to pay attention to the lead-up, the moments when one or both partners stood in a moment of indecision? Who remembers the hovering, the wondering, should we take the plunge? Am I better off on my own? And asking, how will this change me? Because there's no relationship that doesn't bring change, even when your partner isn't the type to push change upon you. And then there are those partners between people or organizations who started out by seeing themselves as enemies. What was the first step, maybe the first glance, that brought them into a place of possibility? When did the impossible start to shift and reform into something possible? So there's a story from Canada that's always reminded me never to rule out unlikely partnerships. It dates back to the late 1980s and mid-1990s in Clockwit Sound off the coast of British Columbia. Some of you may remember that for years, Clockwit Sound was the focus of an intense standoff between the logging company McMillan Bloedel and an alliance of environmentalists and Indigenous people for whom the lands and water had been home for millennia. McMillan Bloedel had obtained the right to use aggressive industrial logging techniques on as much as two-thirds of that land, much of the territory contained old-growth forest. Speaking for the other side was Greenpeace, who'd launched an equally aggressive international awareness campaign. Greenpeace was as bent on making the loggers go away as the loggers were bent on making Greenpeace fade into non-existence. So as the tension heightened and the news began to spread, people from around the world started showing up to protest, and there were as many as 12,000 protesters at one point. You might think of it as the Standing Rock of the late 80s and early 90s. The conflict was fierce, and neither side was willing to budge. And then one early morning in 1993, Karen Mahan, the spokesperson for Greenpeace, was out on the streets of Vancouver, hoping to pick up a coffee. She had her toddler in a stroller she'd just acquired. Blue, she remembered, with white polka dots. For a moment, her attention was caught by the sight of another woman, also pushing a stroller, the same brand, with a child about the same age. And it turned out that the other woman was Linda Cody, vice president and spokesperson for McMillan Bloedel. What followed was an uneasy encounter on the street. The two had never formally met, but they knew each other from frequent face-offs in the media. In the end, Linda introduced Karen to her husband, saying, "I'd like you to meet my arch enemy from Greenpeace, Karen Mahan." So as it turned out, those two women lived in the same neighborhood. Their children were the same age. They loved the same coffee shop. That was that era when coffee shops were starting to become a thing, especially on the West Coast. And that coffee shop had a drop-in for mothers. So they both were living in the same universe, the same local environment. And they ended up deciding that somehow the right thing to do would be to make a date to go for coffee together. And as they started to talk, they discovered all the overlapping things that they had in common. And they eventually moved on to the difficult topic, which was the conflict that both of their lives revolved around. But somehow, as they met, and they met again, and they met again, what began to happen is that they began to feel compassion for one another. They began to sense that they understood each other. And out of that, they each became able to visualize some compromises, some concessions. And when they went back to the bargaining table with their two companies, the leadership of those two women who had already forged an alliance allowed Greenpeace and McMillan Bloedel to begin to start to negotiate finally and de-escalate the conflict and come into a terrain of agreement. So over the past couple of days, quite a few of you have watched me share my enthusiasm for collaboration, and Ursula named it this morning. So it might surprise you to know that I haven't always been a partnership kind of person. Let me explain that although I grew up in Toronto, our home culture was shaped deeply by the influence of my mother. And my mother, an American-born woman of Japanese descent, was raised by parents who never really mastered English. Her parents, so my grandparents, were actually born in 1890 in Japan. So as you can imagine, the culture of their upbringing was more than a world away from the Toronto of the 1960s that I was growing up in. So generally speaking, as you know, cultures like Unitarian Universalism are expected to raise people to understand themselves as individuals first. And our programs like OWL or our adult discussion programs are often oriented toward people discovering, what do I think? What do I believe? What is important to me? But in this household that I grew up in, the idea of the I was not at all, it wasn't that it was valued, but it wasn't part of the skill set that parents were meant to develop. So the Japanese worldview, for any of you who know any Japanese, downplays I to the point that the word I is barely used in Japanese. And indeed, it's considered very rude, especially for women, to say I. So instead, what is promoted in that culture is being vague about our identity, being vague about our wishes. And instead, the onus is on the people around us to figure out what we believe or what we think. That's their job, not our job. So, for example, if I sense you might be hungry, it's my job to quickly suggest we go get something to eat, even though I might not be hungry myself. Or if I sense you might be tired, I'm going to say, let's wrap things up. I think it's time to take a break. And if I sense you might be angry or annoyed at me, in that culture, I should change my way of being so that you might calm down, allowing harmony to be restored. So as you might imagine, being raised like this meant that I found partnerships to be just exhausting. Being with others meant losing myself for the sake of the we. And so, no surprise, I developed a strong preference for doing things alone, so much more straightforward. Except for one problem. The times where I am most likely to feel alive, to feel myself standing on the brink of some exciting sense of purpose and possibility, well, those are the times when I'm engaged with others. I feel most alive when, as part of a group, we struggle to understand, to learn, or to create something. And we touched on some of that in the conversations over the last 2 days, struggling together to try to define what is going on here with pastoral care, with membership. Who are we, meaning you, as a congregation when you think of taking your action out into the world? There's a theological term for this. The process theologian Henry Nelson Wyman calls it creative interchange. But I prefer to think of it simply as the visceral experience of knowing myself to exist and to be alive, which for me happens when I'm engaged in that process where you and I and all of us together are simultaneously trying to figure out what we each think and to bring something entirely new into being, especially when moments before we'd been at some kind of an impasse. I love this kind of challenge. So choosing to go it alone was more comfortable, more predictable, and much, much safer. and yet it closed me off from the experience of being part of something vital, rich, and larger than myself, which I most often found in partnership with others. And so for these reasons, I decided I wanted to learn how to do partnership differently in a way that wasn't just about losing myself in an experience of togetherness. So this meant working, first of all, to learn to hear my own voice, which in the beginning was not at all easy. This meant practicing useful ways of communicating my position to others. And as you know, it's really hard to communicate your disagreement to someone else in a way that doesn't contribute to them getting their hackles up and blocking you out. And then whenever conflict and dissonance began to fill the room, it meant fighting the impulse to withdraw, fighting the impulse to go back to that safe place, which is where there's nobody else and I can do things the way I want. This meant making repeated leaps of faith, trusting that more often than not, life in partnership was richer than the life I could create all on my own. So those of you who are still skeptical about partnerships might find solace in one of the most read, most posted, most shared opinion pieces of 2016. Does anyone know Alain de Botton, the philosopher? He's written a lot about atheism. He wrote an article published in the New York Times called, provocatively, "Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person." I know there are a lot of couples in this room, so take note. "Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person." Its premise: you know how it is when you think you've found the right person. You take note of all the things that coincidentally you have in common. Your wishes and desires seem to overlap just enough that, like magic, you both start imagining a picture of your future together, and it's a future spun out of all the ways in which your wishes match theirs, or perhaps more accurately, the way their wishes match yours. And of course, there's that synergy, the mysterious vibrational energy that feels inexhaustible when we taste it. It's like a fountain of life energy that you somehow feel can only lead to good. And so you commit to a partnership, imagining as you do that this magical energy will be yours for all time, that you can just reach into that place and experience what it was like to first come together. De Botton describes this kind of marriage, which he calls the marriage of feeling, like this. Marriage ends up as a hopeful, generous, infinitely kind gamble taken by two people who don't know yet who they are or who the other might be, binding themselves to a future they cannot conceive of and have carefully avoided investigating. Because you know what happens next. The more you, partners, plunge into the messy reality of being human together, the more you each reveal and discover all kinds of qualities that seem bent on undoing the easy synergy that brought you together in the first place. It's like that, he says, because a lot of what makes us most human only gets revealed over time. Our quirks, our pet peeves, our idiosyncrasies, the things that drive us crazy, and the parts of us that resist forgiveness. The good news in de Botton's story is that, yes, you're going to marry the wrong person. But generally speaking, it's the story that needs to change. Although, of course, there are partnerships that can be dangerously wrong for us, and so this does not mean stay in any partnership regardless, particularly when there's a power imbalance, obviously. Some of those partnerships are not meant to last. But what most likely gets us off track is the myth which says when you find the right partnership, everything will flow seamlessly. Instead, what makes marriage work, and many of you know this, is the ability to speak up lovingly when friction arises to negotiate differences with grace, to be able to laugh together, to laugh at yourself, and to cultivate a generous heart. In other words, it's about how you do partnership as much as who you choose to partner with. I believe our religious movement is at its best when it prepares us to become generous and resilient partners. The Unitarian side of our tradition teaches us to know our own positions and then to fight for the right to speak up and be heard, letting conscience be our guide. But the Universalist side of our tradition reminds us we are all worthy, worthy of love. And it tells us that we are called in this life to make that love manifest in everything we do together. Everything. It may have been hard for me, but for most of us, being Unitarian is the easy part. What's harder is to hold others, especially those who feel different from us, within a circle of love, knowing that this circle is where the magic exists. The circle is where we grow ourselves beyond what exists already and into what is possible. And then let's not forget the power of laughter, of humor. And so in honor of humor and enduring partnerships, I'm going to close with this story about two good friends whose names you surely know. Holmes and Watson went camping in the forest. After a good dinner and a bottle of wine, they went to sleep in the tent. Several hours later, Holmes awoke and nudged his faithful friend, Watson. "Look at the sky and tell me what you see." Watson answered, "I see millions and millions of stars." "And what does that tell you?" Watson thought for a minute and answered, "Astronomically, that tells me that there are potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, I see that Saturn is in Leo. Chronologically, I deduce that it is approximately 3 a.m. Theologically, I see that God is all-powerful and that we are small and insignificant. Meteorologically, I suspect that we shall have a beautiful day tomorrow." Holmes was quiet for a minute and then said, "Watson, you idiot, it means someone stole our tent." This is a time of discernment for you. May the best of your tradition, may your laughter, as well as of, may the best of our beloved Unitarian Universalist tradition be your guide in the weeks to come. May you do this as a circle of love. Blessed be. Oh, and...